Welcome to the Principles of Performance podcast, where we discuss how to optimize your health, fitness, and performance. Drawing on decades of experience of working as coaches, consultants, and trainers to top performers, athletes, and teams from professional sports to top universities to the U.S. military, Eric DeGatti and Mike Perry discuss topics and strategies of how to perform at your highest level and be your very best. Join us and our friends and colleagues who are leaders in the fitness and performance industry as we investigate and challenge the most popular training, nutrition, lifestyle, and recovery protocols. And away we go. Here we are with the Principles of Performance podcast. I'm your host, Eric DeGatti, along with my friend and co-host, Mike Perry. And Perry, we got a couple of your buddies lined up for the next few weeks, including this guest today.
I apologize in advance that I had to, you know, go through the old phone numbers. No, I'm just kidding. Now, we got an old friend here. And Matt, I'm trying to think about sort of when we met. You know, for those of you that don't know, we've got Matt Chatham on today, and I'm going to let Eric do his full bio, but we definitely met either through New England Chapel or through Matt Light, some way, shape, or form, or in that combination of, correct?
It was NEC first, and then I figured out later that you knew Maddie. So it was kind of worlds colliding. But yeah, I think it was definitely New England Chapel first.
Yeah, so it's been a long time, man. And it's a lot of time has passed in between then. I'm doing a lot of different things. You're doing a lot of different things. So it's good to have you on today. But I'm going to let Eric go ahead and, you know, run through your bio, and then we're going to have some fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and one of the reasons Mike and I talked about this is we wanted to get some guests on who could give their experiences. A couple of weeks ago, we had my client, Giuseppe Rossi, who was a pro soccer player for a lot of years and kind of talked about his career and kind of especially some of the injuries that had affected him, and kind of letting people get a glimpse into what it's like. Because a lot of the people either that are, you know, sports fans or fitness enthusiasts that listen to us, or they're the trainers or coaches who want to work with pros or want to know what it's like to work with pros. We want to give you a little bit of insight what it's like to kind of go through that. So let me give you a little bit of a background on Matt. And so he's a former NFL linebacker, came to the pros as an undrafted rookie at a Division II South Dakota in 2000. Spent six seasons with the New England Patriots before joining the New York Jets. Sorry about that. And then playing in 91 games, he totaled 143 combined tackles and recovered two fumbles. One, he returned for 38 yards, and this hurts to say, but for a touchdown against the Giants in 2003, as well as earned himself three Super Bowl rings. But he was a pre-law student coming out of college and doubled in criminal justice and English and returned to school following his playing days and earned an MBA from Babson College. So he spent 12 years as a football analyst with the New England Sports Network, working college games for ESPN and the ACC network. And he also wrote for the Boston Herald and the Athletic. And then June 22, he became one of the students at Babson who wanted to run his own business. So he created a product that he's built his business around, Rub Smoke Love. And we're going to talk all about that. But thanks for coming on the show with us, Matt.
My pleasure. Thanks, Eric. Great introduction. That's everything. That's my entire life. We're good.
So, all right, I'm going to start you off, bud. So let's hear about your journey to the NFL. So let's start with what it was like when you were a kid. What did you do? What sports did you play? Like, give us a little snapshot of what it was like growing up with Matt Chatham.
I'd say, Mike, in contrast to, like, stuff with my own kids now, I was a four-sporter, and, you know, we didn't have this idea of club sports, which is so prevalent up here in the Northeast. So, like, with my own kids, each has two teams, right? They've got their town team or high school team or whatever, and their club team. So with my son, he's on six different teams. It's crazy. My daughter's a little bit younger. She's in the sort of similar vein, but for us, it was everything kind of runs through the YMCA. You know, I played basketball, you know, football, baseball, and what would have been my other one? I guess technically track, but I was terrible at it. But you know, you kind of just sort of stay busy around the calendar, but you only really played the sport you're playing when you're playing. There's no year-round training. It's basically one happens, ends, the next one starts. And that's just kind of how the calendar rolls. So I was a Midwest kid in Sioux City, Iowa, and just was a pretty balanced athlete, to be honest. The football thing, especially at the NFL level, kind of found me more than the other. I was at one point, you know, pretty high-end basketball player in that state. But at 6'4" and, you know, 190 pounds or whatever coming out of high school, yeah, 6'4" is more, you know, in the land of guards these days. And I was sort of more of like a small forward type. So in that regards, football kind of chose me. It's not as if, you know, I thought at that time, hey, maybe I can be this, maybe a pro basketball player as well. But that was not in the cards, and aggressive kid goes and finds football instead.
All right. So I love that you jumped on that, because that's, we talk quite a bit about that, about the long-term athletic development, and it's cool to kind of see it on all angles. You know, Mike has his young kids and he's just turning into psycho dad. I've hung up my psycho dad hat. My kids are both, you know, either in college or out now. And so let's talk about today's youth sports. It's hyper-professionalized, it's specialized. Yep. And so like, how and when do you kind of realize you have something special and that you may have a shot at playing at the higher levels?
So for me, I think prototype kind of does matter, and you sort of have to fit a certain mold to know that you're going to be able to advance. I know that there's sort of the outlier types, the kid that can kind of, you know, just excel, but be, you know, sort of beyond normal boundaries for what would take to get to that next level. I mentioned it with basketball, of course, as a 6'4", 6'5", type guy, you're not going to go play power forward in the NBA. It's just not going to happen. So then you've got to be some sort of alternative thing that doesn't exist. So you kind of at that moment look ahead, and in candor, I think they look back at you the same way. You know, the college recruiters are like, okay, how would this work? And for football with me, I was actually having this discussion with a text chain of a bunch of guys at USD. USD was a Division II school when I was there. It's an FCS school now. 1AA, it's grown and grown and grown. So they get a decent amount of sort of the fringe, gonna make the NFL or not type guys each and every year. But I actually played my freshman season at USD as a free safety, not a strong safety, like a Urlacher before Urlacher grew and moved down to the line kind of thing. So I played middle of the field at 6'4 plus and about 190, 95 pounds as a true freshman. So I was recruited as basically the only division, the only non-BCS level school that I had in my recruiting sort of trails was USD. It was kind of my, and this sounds derogatory and I hate it now because I had an excellent experience there, but it was kind of my backup school. You know, I desperately wanted to go to the University of Iowa. I grew up a Hawkeye fan, took my official visit there, took another secondary one that was not official, more me courting them as opposed to in the other direction. So they had actually passed. And I think part of, you know, they went down to sort of signing day, guy did a hat flip thing, and chose University of Texas Austin. That was a safety kid that I was basically competing with for that scholarship. So they gave me the sort of, hey, you can be a priority walk-on kind of thing. And I'd already turned down a couple other schools just waiting on that basket to come from Iowa, and it didn't come. So my parents were very hardcore middle class, and it's maybe even stretching to say that. And they're like, you're going where you already have a full ride. You're not doing this priority walk-on. Maybe it'll be a full ride next year kind of thing. So I simply mentioned that to say that I was probably a little non-profile for a Big Ten. What are you going to do with a maybe almost 6'5 guy? Is he really going to play safety once he grows? And I was a little young on the young side for birthdays. My kids are that way now too. I've got June and May birthdays. So a lot of July 1 cutoffs in this state. So your kids are really on the low end as far as age. A lot of their classmates are full year older than them. So I was that way too coming out. So it's like, okay, there's going to be a physical change that'll be dramatic, might be lagging by year kind of thing. But is he going to get to be like a 6'4", 250 guy that you would presume would be more profile? Or there aren't a lot of 6'4", 6'5 direction changers on the back end. And Cam Chancellor, I mean, you can't really think of a lot of those. So I was also a pretty good baseball player, all-state baseball player. And I think for a lot of kids struggle with this, that have some ability in the, you know, middle school and club sports and then get into high school and excel, you have to basically do my commitments and my hardcore recruiting for the fall sport. So I'm making a decision about where I'm going to go for college because that sport takes place in September and October, November, right? And I haven't even gotten to my senior baseball season. And, you know, I batted 430 as a junior. I'm big, tall, big arm center fielder with range. So lefty, you know, there was something there, but I'm making a decision, you know, late in the year before my senior season had even begun. So that's kind of always one of those things where, again, the calendar seemed to choose it for me a little bit. Basketball, I was hopeful, but don't fit the profile. So you know, I was kind of left to do football, and then I grow into this body and end up being a 250 plus guy, and was always super aggressive and probably played the other sports like a football player would. I think it does eventually kind of find you, but it is a little unusual how the paths are a little murky as you're getting there.
Now, there's a fine line between being realistic and then being kind of a dream crusher, like, because every right. parent's always seeing the story of, you know, well, Michael Jordan got cut from his high school basketball team. And, you know, Tom Brady was, you know, had to overcome all he did. But people forget, like, Tom Brady also got drafted into the major leagues as a baseball player, too. These guys were also exceptional athletes, and they're outliers. They're the best in the world at what they've ever done. So it's hard to kind of put your kid, especially at a young age when they're not developed, in that situation. So, you know, where do you draw that line, and what kind of advice do you give? And you being a parent, to say, like, how do you know when to push the pedal down? How do you know when you know it's worth, you know, investing thousands of dollars and hours into club sports that may end up leading nowhere? You probably would have been better off investing in a tutor or putting that in a college fund. You know what I mean?
Right. I think the movement screen stuff is super important, in that you have to, in any of the sports, be able to move a certain way and at a certain level, and those thresholds can't be worked around, right? Jordan is still a 6'6 guy. He could still leap out of the gym. Maybe his development hit a little bit later, but he was an incredible athlete. And I think being sort of, you know, we'll put it this way. I coached youth football through 6th, 7th, and 8th grade with my son, and you can really tell where there's going to become an issue where the guys don't move quite as well. Speed and quickness, strength, and all that stuff kind of comes into play. But you can be the greatest hand-eye coordination guy when the field shrink. But as the fields grow, you know, as you move sort of through the ranks, soccer's another one where you often see the young athlete that'll score 10 goals a game when the field is small. Things get a little bigger. You've really got to cover more ground, or you're not going to be able to advance at the other athletes as they grow. I think sometimes those decisions get made for you. I have one example, and I won't out the kid. He's actually still playing right now, and I think he'll be a fine college player at some level. But you look at the parents, and I hate to say this, but it's kind of part of it, right? You're not going to grow to 6'6 if mom and dad are both 5'9. That's kind of how this works. I mean, you may outgrow them a little bit, but I had an excellent, excellent offensive lineman at sort of that 8th grade level, who I knew was going to be a really good high school player. But mom and dad are maybe tops out at 6 foot, but he's more like a 5'11 guy. And this kid is super aggressive. He's very strong. Yeah, he's now in high school at King Philip. And I'm not going to say his name, but he awesome weight room guy. Moves really well, and I think that's obviously one of the things that keeps the thought alive that you could go to another level. Like, unusually quick feet, moves like a smaller man even though he's in a bigger frame. I think that attribute is something that can translate. So if you have that in conjunction with the frame, there's possibly something there. But I think for his issue is, and it's not something you want to talk about through the high school level, go play your games, do your spot. I think it's more about choosing a position. They are not at the bigger programs going to put a 5'11 tackle out there, right? They're just not going to do it. They're not going to put, and they're a little hard pressed to even do it at guards anymore. At a lot of the bigger programs, there's sort of this real stigma that if you're that size, but this kid is so athletic and was a center for us at the younger levels. It's sort of like you're nudging them. You're pushing them over. It's like, man, it's not so much what I believe you could do. It's what all these other evaluators looking back at you are going to see. And maybe you'll have one with sort of the vision that I'm going to have the outlier kid that's going to be able, you know, become a All-American for me at guard, even though he's maybe sub 6 foot or right at it. Or you find the spot where, hey, the norm is actually, there's a lot of right around 6 foot centers that are smaller, athletic, they move, but they're still super strong from a little bit smaller frame. So I think part of that is kind of the exercise you go through, trying to help the kid find the spot where the path would be most realistic.
And it helps to pick the right parents too.
That's true. Yeah, you gotta have a breeder. You gotta marry the power forward. Yeah,
that's called the Soviet Union.
exactly.
So, you know, question for you, and this is you know, something that I've been thinking about too. You know, I've been coaching for 20 years. I've worked with people at the highest level. You've played in the highest level. Do you ever feel that it's tough as a parent, sort of wearing the coach hat? and then wearing the parent hat, because, you know, there's one part of you that like, look, this is the path that takes X. Obviously the path is going to be very different now, but like, there's gotta be, at least for me, there's this sort of back and forth. It's like, how hard do I push them? Because I know that there's more, but at the same time, you don't want to like, you don't want to make them crazy and make them hate the sport. So, I mean, how do you strike that balance as a coach and as a dad?
So I think one of the biggest, we have sort of a little subculture, obviously. I don't know if Matt's ever spoken of this with you, but it's when you got to play at the highest level for a long time and you sort of become known that sort of being like the first line in your profile kind of deal. When you have kids and, you know, the hundreds of different guys I played with over the years, pretty much all of them have children. They kind of all deal with this same thing. It's, am I trying to replicate me or even go beyond what I did with some other human that I made with my wife? Or can we just let this happen naturally? And I mean, I think there are as many, you know, success stories, and I hate to even use, I shouldn't say success, but guys that end up being the comparable athlete to mom and dad in that sort of subculture, they're out there. I mean, Rosie Colvin's son is killing it at Purdue right now. His daughter is actually one of the best volleyball players in the Big Ten. Steve Neal's, both of his daughters are just tremendous volleyball players. Bobby Hamilton's, Grant Williams. We had several guys. Lawyer Malloy's got that, you know, Olympic athlete level girls, but in softball. But I simply say that to say it's not so hard to pick and choose the ones that fit it. There are a lot more children in those trees that aren't, right? And that's kind of the tough part, right? So in my family, and maybe I'll hope Lex, my son, doesn't catch this, but Lex is a very good athlete. He's, you know, he's a high school involved in everything, good hockey player, good football player, good baseball player. But I don't think we're having that conversation about going to do it in college necessarily. He's the good, not great athlete, but he's an awesome teammate, loves to be involved in the sports, and that's what drives him. That's why we're willing to spend the money on the club stuff, basically for the inclusion angle. Just to keep him involved, keep him where his friends are. And but it's not necessarily going somewhere else. My daughter, on the other hand, she's doing that Massachusetts ODP, the Olympic Development Program stuff at 11 years old. She's a monster. She's just – and she's the athlete, right? And it's not, you know, as the man who played in the NFL, you know, it's she's good at stuff that I didn't do. And my son, I didn't replicate another version of me. And that's just kind of how life works. So I think part of it is – my biggest thing is just wanting to get the most out of them, whatever their thing is. But with my son, it's easier when you kind of, you know, and I talked about sort of the movement screen stuff earlier. I mean, when a guy has a certain sort of ability to move and foot speed isn't generally something you can exponentially change over time. Of course, we do the, you know, the bigger, faster, stronger stuff and all the speed school things. And you can make people faster. I'm not saying that, but you're not going to take a 5.5 and turn them into a 4.5. It just, you know, it's more inches and incremental stuff. So when the foot speed's not there, I know that there's no reason to just grind a kid down to try to make him something that's more of a fairy tale in your own head. But I think when you have a child that does have that natural sort of thing, yeah, then it's okay to cultivate it, but you don't want to burn them out. And that's the biggest thing that, you know, you hear that 1,000 times, but we just, you know, that's the biggest concern in the back of my head. Like in the instance of my daughter, she's amazing, but she's down to, at 11 years old already, just two sports. She could have been a good lacrosse player. She's down to just doing the AAU basketball and this crazy soccer schedule. And I'm thinking those two sports all the way through high school will be absolutely enough for her. But yeah, very leery of the idea that eventually she ends up hating it, you know, because it's so much. So we're in a schedule right now, Mike, where she goes to Lancaster a couple times a week. She goes to the club soccer, which practices like 3 times a week or whatever. Then we have weekend tournaments. She pretty much has a 7-day-a-week thing, and she's 11. And that's before this AAU schedule kicks in for basketball here in a couple months, and it'll start to overlap a little bit. So I don't know how to sort of, I don't know, affiliate myself with that, because I didn't experience it, and it feels like an overload already, and we're not even into the real stuff.
Now, I got to imagine there's some pressure on you also being the dad that was a former NFL player and kind of, well, what do you think, Matt? What do you think? Is this offensive coordinator really sucks, doesn't he? And, you know, yeah, there's a great, there's a great thing, me being a baseball guy, there's a great thing that went around of like where each prototypical parent stands in the baseball field. Like there's the dad who overcoaches behind home plate with the camera. Yep. And then there's the dad who actually plays and knows what he's talking about, goes in right field, doesn't stand by anybody. There's the parents who drink down in left field, like where everybody goes. And so, you know, I would always tell my kids when they were getting like, you know, oh, Mr. So-and-so keeps saying this. And I go, those are the words of a guy who never wore a pair of cleats in his life. Right. Because no one would ever say that to who's ever actually played to say, well, you know, like the one line we were joking about the other day, when he came into the dugout, so it and said, you know, you guys don't want it enough. And it's like, that's not how baseball works. Like I really wanted to hit that curveball. I just missed it. I didn't want to bobble the ball at second base, but that happens sometimes. Right. So like being the dad has got to be a little bit, because everybody's looking to you to say, well, what should they do? Right.
I think one of the best points of perspective, I think, that helped me how to be a better dad in that environment is remembering how little I could actually hear when I was on the field. Right. There's a moment where, I mean, if I'm say my son's a third baseman and he's a pitcher, and you know, if I'm doing the lurking father thing behind home, I've actually kind of gone to a place now where I know if he's pitching or if he's up the bat, I don't want to be in his purview. I don't want him to feel me, you know, which is a conflict in its own. I mean, there's a little bit of a contradiction there because you want them to be able to handle pressure, but you just don't want you to be the pressure. You don't have the contest itself to be the pressure. So I don't want to be catching, you know, I want him throwing a ball or a walk happening and then we flash eyes. Like that's, I'm unnecessarily adding sort of stones to the pile if that's the case. So I've kind of gone from where maybe I would have done that at younger ages. So, you know, I'm the guy that's playing catch with them and we're working on some thinking of him as a pitcher. Now we're working on certain, you know, things that are going to be keys for him. We've gotten to and I don't like echoing these in games because he knows them, you know, he's a smart kid. I've gone to something I think that worked a little better with me, where a text message with maybe two or three bullet points going into the game, things that you want to focus on, things that you're going to remember. I always used to write those two or three things, would encourage that because the contest gets crazy. You can't remember seven things. You can't remember 10. You don't want to have like a whole lesson on your arm. But if it's just a one liner that, hey, today define my center, I'm going to remember this one thing, or maybe it's two. I feel like that's a little more effective, even if you have to just, if, as a father, you're blurting out, remember, you know, or some sort of auditory, token to say, oh yeah, okay, you know, yes, remember those couple fundamentals, as opposed to screaming out, keep your head down, you know, one of those sort of, you know, bad dad golf.
Throw strikes. Yeah, that's my favorite. Yeah, thanks, Dad.
Just play catch. Yeah, like, wheels. Okay, that's wheels. What I'm doing.
Wheels.
Right. So no, I found that it's there are ways. You don't want to not be there, but you're not a private coach during the contest. It's you just kind of have to find, you know, the balance there.
Absolutely. Oh, I love that. I can't wait to listen to this again for my own advice. So look, we're going to talk about the career for a little bit. You know, what is a common attribute or maybe a handful of common attributes that you saw with the guys that really made it in the NFL?
They're all crazy. Like I know a lot of them,
so I can attest to that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a psychosis that goes on with people that are the best. And, you know, I got to that level. I think in the world of special teams, I was one of the best, but that's sort of a niche within the NFL that most people don't know about. But I would say I was the, you know, one of the best in my little world, but then you get to meet the Tom Brady's of the world and guys like that. And Tom is, as much as I thought I liked football, as much as I thought as I like competing, he was even crazier, you know, exponentially. So, I personally, it was in my 10th training camp, it was the third one there with the Jets. I had basically been having conversations with my wife, Erin, dating back two camps from then. They're like, are we done? You know, like this is, you know, kind of mentally, I've had enough of this. My body's beat up. I'm sitting here now at in my mid to late 40s, I guess it would be. And I'm 14 some surgeries in. So, you know, I was kind of getting into that body wore down kind of phase. I think what really separates the best of the best is just a little bit crazy, because most of the stuff and most of the decisions we're making to get to that point aren't terribly rational. You know, I've Tom is an example, just because, you know, he basically did three careers to what most of us did. Like, you know, like most of my friends are 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 year type guys. There's a handful that have gotten, you know, the 10 or more, and those are sort of the lifers. I sit kind of in the middle of that, where I was 9 when I was leaving. And, you know, that, so I know guys on that have not gotten quite as many that would have loved to have gotten a few more. And then some of those other guys that maybe did a 12 or 13 or 14, the cash is great, of course, you love that part, but maybe did it for a year or two more than they otherwise would have. But when you start talking about a guy like Tom, who puts together really sort of like three pocket careers, three groups of friends and people that were around him, that's not just, hey, he's great at football. Like, mentally, there's something different there to want to do that. Like, it wasn't even that I loved playing. I loved playing. We all loved playing. But it does get to the point where the only part I liked was the game. You know, and I think the crazy element gets into, in my view, and again, crazy is subjective, I guess, but the people that actually like the training and the cycle and the stuff in May and the stuff in August, as much as they do as the stuff in, a, you know, 8:30 at night on November and a Sunday, I don't. So I think the guys that are the yellow jacket guys that also have the physical gifts to go with it have that little extra craziness. Now, I say all that, and, you know, the locker room's still littered with guys that are a little bit nutty, but just not as skilled, who would do it forever if you'd allow them, or if their bodies would have allowed them. But I think it's just an under sort of sold attribute that this is not a rational pursuit. I really, really love the outlet of being violent with other people and having this place where the things I'm going to do aren't going to get me arrested. And that's weird. And I hear myself saying that. I know that's insane, but you kind of have to be into that to go want to do that deal.
Hey, everybody, a quick break in the action here. Hope you're enjoying the show and we appreciate you listening. We're working hard to bring you the highest quality content and best guests every single week. So if you could do us a big favor and go and like and subscribe to the show on whatever platform you get your podcasts on, it would be greatly appreciated. Be sure to listen at the end of the show also to find out more information about our courses, as well as a special discount code for all our listeners. Thanks again, and let's get back to the show. I have a couple follow-ups to that, Mike, if I could jump in. So one, I always remember a great line. John Terrine is a great friend of ours. He was a strength coach for the Colts for many years. And he said, when you stand on the sideline before a game, and Marvin Harrison would say to me, he goes, "You pay me for Monday through Saturday." He goes, "Today it's on me." He goes, this is the truth. He goes, "You're paying me for that Monday through Saturday stuff." So help people kind of understand and appreciate, who only see the NFL through their TV sets, the degree of physicality and the violence that happens when that ball gets snapped.
Yeah. So I think, Eric, one of the biggest, and it's not in today's game, but that was incredibly taxing, I guess, for my body, but I love to do, but I pay for it later kind of thing, was the way special teams were then. And so I'm an outside linebacker as a rotation guy, usually sort of, you know, Willie and Mike Vrabel are the starters, and then Roosevelt Colvin later, and I'm kind of the third. So I know I'm going to have to play somewhere in that 10 to 20 play range of defense. And the big collisions you get from an outside guy are basically pulling guards. Pulling guards are direct runs with fullbacks. So those collisions are sort of, you know, a pretty hefty, especially when it's, you know, pulling guard that's skipping a few gaps from the backside. Guy's 320, you know, he's got a 5 yard run. So, you know, just the, whatever it is, the force and the mass times acceleration thing. Like, he's super heavy. It's like hitting a car, but he didn't get a, you know, a huge run at you. So you can kind of hold your ground. And even though you're a little deficient in those areas, it's not going to kill you. But that's sort of the science of being on the outside. And you're not going to see much more than that. You know, some of the, gosh, what's his last name? It was Sellers for the Redskins. Was a 270, 280 type fullback. You know, there's some teams that would carry that kind of guy. And you just know there's going to be 10 of these collisions. And, man, my neck's going to get shorter. And there's going to be a bad Monday and all that kind of stuff. But those were kind of those kind of hits and then whatever the arithmetic would be that you get on a given week. That's the most of it physically, other than the just, you know, the collisions and roll around and stuff like that for tackles. But special teams. Special teams is what was different then, much different, I think, than now, because we had wedges and because most special teams units are made up of safeties and corners and then a couple linebackers. And I was a 6'4", 250s kind of guy. So most teams had that, like, backup tight end or defensive end or bigger linebacker that could run. And that role is almost like you're sort of the bully or you're the, you know, bodyguard of the group of more athletic guys. So you kind of have to have a few bigs to go with, you know, the rest of your speedster guys. So for me, I was usually the guy that would hit the wedge and have to set the edge and people kind of play off you. But I had the weird role. I was a captain for the Jets later in my career. And we had our special teams coach here, Mike Westhoff, had this idea that we were going to have the fastest, most agile wedge. And I'm using that nomenclature. And I don't know if everyone out there remembers what the wedge was, but it was basically the back end where you'd have three, four guys, basically almost link arms. And usually it would be offensive linemen or bigger defensive tackle types that would just run together and you had to hit it and stop it. It basically became the force, like you'd have in a run play to turn the ball back inside. So the thing that sucked for me was, you know, I'm one of the bigs who's expected to hit it fine. You kind of survive that part. But then I would flip around and be in it in New York. I wasn't in New England. In New England, I'd be a frontline blocker, which was a lot less of this. But the Jets had this idea that, hey, you're the captain, you're going to be the center of the wedge, and you'll set in front of the returner, and then we'll follow you. We're going to be fast and agile and super aggressive, and you love to hit and all that. But the line I would always use is, if I had seen me as the center of the wedge, I would have killed me. Because the other 250s and the other 260s are going to tee up on that kind of body type. So as far as, you know, just what is sort of taxed on your body. I have a text chain with some other college football buddies. We keep in contact. And I was kind of going through basically the cocktails that I had to deal with that I'm completely clean now. I don't even like ibuprofen if I can avoid it. Anything to take care of a migraine is about as far as I'll go. But back in the day, it was Vioxx for anti-inflammatories or Indocin, which was a little rough on the kidneys. So try not to do that as much as you could. Vicodins on game day, Vicodin during the week if you were dealing with something, but try to keep off on those as much as you can because it gets very addictive, obviously. T2s, something like the Tylenol with the codeine, if you're having an issue, you could pair with one of those and be pretty effective. I love Ambien, helps you sleep. Your body's so beat up, you're restless, right? You know, you're flopping in the bed every couple hours kind of thing. Wasn't an Adderall guy, but I know that has sort of become popular now for the focus drug or whatever. But that's a laundry list to simply say that a big part of the NFL is pain management, quite frankly, just to get through it all. Because, you know, it's just those car crashes, car crashes, car crashes. And when you're in the 250s and you have to hit the 310s and 320s, like, you know, there's a deficit there. It's gonna wear on you. So a lot of body work. You're constantly getting massages. You're constantly doing hot and cold contrasts, stretching like crazy, and taking a lot of pills. I mean, that's just really, I don't know another way around it. I'm not sure exactly how guys handle it now. It'd be great if you could get a Toradol shot on a Wednesday, but they don't let you do that. And I understand that's not terribly healthy anyhow. So yeah, I mean, that's what you deal with. And I think now in post-career, you know, I'm many years removed now, but sleep is tough. You know, I was actually Giants were one of the teams I worked out for after. So the Jets had cut me and I had been basically cut injured. I couldn't pass a physical after camp. It was the Favre year that where he had come and, you know, did the 1 year with us. I had a bunch of neck problems. So I was doing treatment there around sort of the Jets facilities with some of the people I saw before, but now I'm not on the team. I got where I thought the neck was right. Like, I was having this issue. I'd hit the guard all through camp and all through training camp. And right after contact, you go back to the huddle for the next play and it would take me up to the next whistle. Where I could feel my legs below my knees. Like, it would, you know, I was just having this like pinch thing in my neck. And worked out for the Giants, ran an atrocious 40. They looked at my neck. They're like, no. You know, like, so in that particular year, then I worked out for the Eagles, or I believe it was, and then the Bengals, something like that. But I couldn't pass anyone's physical. I was kind of just this like broken thing. that nobody for liability reasons is going to hire at that in their 30s. So at the very end of that season, this was the year where the Cardinals played the Steelers in the Super Bowl. You'll remember James Harrison, you know, picking it off and taking it back the length of the field, all that. So I had failed a bunch of physicals at the beginning of the season and was like, okay, he's not right yet. Let's see if you can get ready and squeeze one final season out of it. So I worked out for the Cardinals as the playoffs were beginning, or maybe just right before then, and thought, hey, I've done all this work, but my neck is passable, not great. I flew out to Arizona. I had a conversation through my agent. We had good relationships there. A lot of that staff was from Pittsburgh, and we'd played them for years in teams, and I'd always done really well against them. And they were just, hey, let's get Chatham for the run. That'll be great. And I came down. They weren't going to make me run a 40. That's good. Nobody wants to know that number in your 30s. But they took me in to check out the neck, and it's just, you know, you look bad, you look like Humpty Dumpty on an MRI. So you go in and do the, you know, the tryout, and it's, you're 31 or whatever I was, and 32, and everyone else in the room is 22 and 23 and just kind of trying to get in the league, and they're doing like a late workout. I'm like, damn it. So they all leave the hospital. You hang back behind, and I'm like, I'm there for 4 hours. I'm like, they're not going to sign me. So I actually came out of that. They said, hey, we would have intended to sign you. That's why we flew you out here. But the scans just look scary. And they said, on your flight home, we'd recommend you go see your doctor. We have concerns that you might have MS. Okay. So I didn't get the gig. I guess this means football's over. And I go, what MS? So what it ended up being is that issue I was having with my neck. There was, looked like calcium deposits or some sort of, just basically like purple spots, a contusion on my spine. And all that was is I had a lot of spur buildup, and I was having these big, huge collisions, and it would tick the spine, just the core, just enough that there was some discoloration there. And that is apparently some sort of sign of MS. But I didn't have it, but it was just, you know, the contact spot, but it freaked them out, freaked me out. And I've sort of had a life of, since that point, of persistent neck problems. So sleep upright, basically, in one of the hospital bed type things. And just I'm constantly doing traction and going to PT just to be able to, you know, make it through a day. So, but I mean, that's, I don't have the CTE problems. I don't have any like major knee things. So I'm probably relatively lucky, but it's a lot. It's a lot, silly.
Yeah, as you're saying some of these stories, I remember some of the things that guys would tell me. And one thing that stood out in my mind, one of our big money vets, I remember him telling me, he came in, he's like, on a Monday, he's like, man, on Monday, do I hate football? And he said, by Wednesday, I don't mind football. And he goes, then Friday, I get my paycheck and I fucking love football. And so that was kind of the cycle of the week. So I got to go know before Mike gets to his next question, because you mentioned that you played for Mike Westhoff, who is the king of one-liners. It made me one of the most entertaining Hard Knock seasons there ever was. Give me your best one-liner you got from Mike Westhoff.
Well, I'll give you the one-liner, but I think the backstory on this is I have a really, really good relationship with Mike. I loved him. I mean, he fought for me to be there. He fought for me and screamed at the general manager when the general manager cut me. He was like, what the hell? Like, you're our captain. What are you doing? Kind of thing. So he was definitely a go-to-bat guy for me, all the way through it. But like you said, Mike is kind of known for his funny one-liners. And there was we had one of our returners, a guy named Justin Miller. Justin was from Clemson, good corner of ours, but one of the best kick returners for a couple of years span there in the NFL. And we'd had, you know, multiple kick returns for touchdowns. And, you know, we had a really strong group of teams guys there in New York. And I think Mike is instrumental in that. He pushes for them to spend on guys like me, to bring in those kind of people that play their position, but also are good at that stuff too. But anyhow, the point is we had a really deep group. We had a great group of blockers. It was, you know, our returner was awesome, but we put a pretty good map out in front of him too. And we had brought one back. I believe it was in the Cleveland game, road game there, brought back a kick return for a touchdown. And you know, Mike is up in front of the room on Monday, and Justin's been named AFC Special Teams Player of the Week. And Mike is standing at the podium. He's got the little announcement. He's the first one who's going to be able to tell Justin that he's gotten it. And after he tells Justin, you know, we're all kind of just doing the, hey, that's, you know, good stuff, and clapping for him or whatever. And then Mike, in relatively serious tone says, I should have gotten it. They were my returns. You just ran where we told you to. And it was like, oh, great line. I'm like, no, he was dead serious. He's like, yeah, those were my returns. It was classic Mike Westhoff. But no, he's a stud. I love playing for him.
All right. So, do you have anything else you want to add, Eric?
No, that was I was dying to hear.
All right, we know we're coming up against time. We got two different things we want to cover. Let's talk about Super Bowl 38. Let's talk about when the streaker came out. Walk us through that. Okay. Walk us through that experience.
Yeah. So, Mike, the weird part about that particular thing is the security, right? Because we're post 9/11, but just a couple years removed here. So every time there's this sort of somber seriousness about big events. Because the threats, you know, we're doing the Iraq thing around that time and the threats of people infiltrating stadiums and bombs and no flyovers and like everything is weird with security. So that's kind of like the super serious thing to it, which is why it kind of had a little different tenor when it was going on, because this wasn't at the beginning of the game. This happens at halftime. Guy's name is Mark Roberts. Apparently does this all around the country, Wimbledon and British Opens. And he's been doing it, you know, for years and years. But he had bought or he'd been sponsored by Golden Palace, one of the online offshore gambling things back in the day when he had to do that. And he had painted his body with that stuff, but he'd been wearing an official's uniform to the game. So the reason I bring up the whole 9/11 and weird security stuff is, you know, we'd been briefed the night before about all these different things we had been doing, even different than like 36, a couple of years prior to that. So we're kind of the mind that, man, we're in the, you know, we've been told this, we're in the safest place in the world. Like nobody's getting anywhere near this place. And the wild thing with that was he jumps out of the stands. And I know it's that he fooled them a little bit with the officials thing, but he rips it off, does his little dance. He was out there for almost 40 some seconds. And there was a weird moment between it, Larry Izzo's to my right and Brewski's behind me at the upback spot. And I'm left guard on this kick return. And we're all kind of looking at each other like, is this funny or is this scary or what the hell's happening? We were told exactly this wouldn't happen. And it's not like, hey, ran on the field and got attacked. It persisted. And it wasn't like, there was a weird moment. You can kind of, some of the YouTube videos where Bruce eyes are darting around and Izzo's got his arms up. Like, you know, do we react? What the hell are we going to run into if we do? But so eventually from sort of the end zone, that's far to me there. They started chasing him. At that little later time, NFL security got after him and he made his way towards me. And yeah, then we just wiped him out. But I thought part of the reason I was more annoyed, to be honest, it wasn't like a, you know, screw this guy or whatever. But you know, we were in a really tight first half. That was the one where us and the Panthers, and it's like a, you know, really defensive sort of slugfest in the first half, field position kind of game, and then wild scoring in the second. But we just come out of halftime, serious speech, holding, we got to pick this up. And then, you know, I'm about to do my job and this guy's out here dancing in front of me. So it was more like, why is he here? You told us this wouldn't happen. And then, you know, get the fuck out of here. I got a job to do. So it was very businesslike, I think, at that point. So,
yeah, it's interesting because I don't think a lot of people realize kind of the background. Obviously, they look at, what do they see? They see like what most of us see. They see a guy out that's almost naked dancing. And that's right. Like entertaining. But again, the backstory of that is a lot of things I don't think people understand. But so as we sort of get towards the end, let's talk about your newest company, Rub Smoke Love. How did this come about? I know obviously we've talked about the entrepreneurial journey, but let's talk about why you've gotten into the barbecue world.
Yeah. So when I was at Babson, you know, I'd retired, filed my papers after that whole incident with the Cardinals and realized that was going to be it. I am one of several people in New York. I'm sure there's other NFL cities like this too, but I had built a nice big new house on an 06 contract and the housing market just crashed there around 08. So that was the time where, oh gosh, I've got this big property on Long Island and where I thought I was taking my family was to Colorado. I'm a big skier. You know, we bought property in Keystone. I thought I was going to go settle out there and go to get my MBA maybe in Boulder or something like that. Right. But I'm stuck with this giant property and had no intention of staying in New England, quite frankly. But hey, I'm, you know, big house. I got to rent this thing and I can't dump it. I kept my condo from when I played with the Pats. So I'm just going to go stay there for a couple of years and go get my MBA because I'm going to get into some investment stuff and different business stuff. And I don't have a background for it. I was a pre-law guy. So we moved back up here, lived in Bellingham while I was going to do the Babson thing. And Babson, I applied at Harvard, Babson, and BC, and end up choosing Babson in part because it's kind of that small classroom feel. And it is like, you know, the epicenter of entrepreneurship and really the world as far as the university level. So won all sorts of awards for that. It was kind of like, if that's what you want to do, that's where you should go. If it was finance, yeah, you go to BC. If it's any litany of other things for Harvard, but that was where it was at. And there are so many food entrepreneurs in this place. It's wild. So I left, you know, and I've kind of always had, I owned some restaurants early on, or a restaurant concept for crepes right when I left Babson, but I was doing the, concurrently doing the Nesson thing at that time. So I did all these years of sort of being the analyst and kind of got to a point where I was like, you know what, I don't want to be doing that till 65. I want to get into sort of running my own company and getting back into food. And it was just really easy to pick up that phone, run through all the emails and click into that network. And wanted to do it from the production side. I think a lot of the NFL guys, the former players, I'll tell you, owning restaurants and bars, it's rough, man. Like it's a lifestyle. It's 80 hours a week and midnight phone calls and all that kind of stuff. And I wasn't as interested in that as actually getting into a production company. So our angle with the Rubs is we're all natural, which is actually very unusual in Rubs. There's a lot of sort of alphabet soup on the back of most rub bottles. A lot of anti-caking agents that aren't particularly good for you. You'd be surprised that there's still people using, what's the term in Asian cooking? Why can't I think of it?
MSG?
The additive that you, MSG. Like just the idea that in 2024, there's people still putting MSG in a, well, it's something that's usually a 5 or 6 ingredient kind of rub. It blows my mind. But so our big idea was basically two things. Wanted to make it all natural. Could we make a formula good enough? Could we nail the chemistry to where we didn't have to have a lot of these other goofy things in there? And then the other side of it was I'd always sort of been a bit of a foodie and love to entertain and have people over and smoke food and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was always something that like lay people could really master without having to go to culinary school with just a little sort of how to. But the easiest way to nail a cut of meat is to brine it in advance. And it's really tough if you're, you know, you're busy schedule, you got kids, sports and all that kind of stuff. And you're just going to stop by the butcher or the grocery store or whatever on the way home and pull something out of cellophane and throw it on the grill and hope for it to be great. It doesn't really work that way, or at least you decrease your odds. So her idea was to take a lot of the salt out of the rubs so that you could properly dry brine in advance, heading to school, heading to work, before you go to night at bed or bed at night. Sprinkle a little of that salt on it because it's just magical. The flavor will actually travel to the center of the piece of meat and it helps lock in a lot of flavor and it really helps with tenderness and remaining juicy. It's just a quick and easy step that I think all people should do with a cut of pork, chicken, or beef. Doesn't really matter what it is. But if you promote that, your rubs then have to be lower sodium because if it's full sodium, like most stuff you see on the shelves, then when you put the rub on, it's going to be overly salted. So it's really kind of a two-step philosophy. And we've got three major products, Beefcake, Gold Bark, and a Gold Bark Bold. Beefcake is sort of a reconstructed pastrami rub, but that we changed a few things out there to make sure it's plenty versatile for really any cut of beef. It's great as a butter burger on burgers. Awesome on steaks, pulled beef, up and down the line. The Gold Bark product is actually, we call it Carolina barbecue. That's a little bit fusion because we have some herbs in there that are more associated with Asian cooking. So that's kind of an angle there that's sort of combining cultures kind of deal, but it just is a distinctive note and kind of falls on a lot of the other qualities we talked about. And then Gold Bark Bold just basically adds some spicier spice to that. So for people that really want a little extra heat. So it's been fun, man. I'm having a blast. And I think our store count should hit somewhere in the 300s later this summer. And, you know, that's only in about 16 or 17 months of operation. So it's been growing fast and we're doing really well.
I'm going to have to keep an eye out, see if there's anything up this way. So
there you go. Yeah, we're in all the big Y's, and I think the best thing is just go to rubsmokelove.com, and it's got the store list. I whenever I go down this road, I always end up leaving off someone and then feeling bad, like I got to go call some vendors or clients.
Say, hey, sorry, I didn't mention you.
Didn't mention you, yes, exactly.
Awesome.
Well, we will definitely have that link up there, and this has been spectacular. And what other podcasts are you going to get long-term athletic development Mike Westhoff stories and how to cook a steak all in 1 hour. I don't know where you're getting that. You're not getting that anyplace else. And we appreciate you for sharing your time with us, Matt, and sharing your stories. It's been great. And want to thank you all for listening. And this has been the Principles of Performance podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Principles of Performance podcast. If you've enjoyed our content, please like and share on your social media outlets, as well as subscribe and give us a review on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred platform is to listen to. For more information on the Principles of Program Design courses and workshops, visit us at www.principlesofprogramdesign.com and follow us on all of the social media channels where we post new content every day. To save 10% on any PPD courses, enter the discount code PRINCIPLESPODCAST10 at checkout. If you have any questions we can answer or suggestions for the show, you can email us at info@principlesofprogramdesign.com or message us on social media. Thank you again for your support.